This episode, I'm joined by Mark Sedgwick, who is a British historian specialising in the study of traditionalism, Islam, and Sufi mysticism. In this episode, we discuss his book, Western Sufism, From the Abbasids to the New Age, alongside discussions on Neoplatonism, J.G. Bennett, George Gurdjieff, and more. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paid patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you would like to support Hermetics and keep the podcast going indefinitely for as little as $2.50 a month, please find links in the description below. A little does go a long way. Also, if you would like to become part of the community, there are also links in the description below. Enjoy. So, Mark Sedgwick, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics Podcast. We are going to be discussing your book, Western Sufism, From the Abbasids to the New Age, which was published by Oxford University Press, I believe, in 2016.
Yes, something like that.
Okay. So this is a book which obviously is dealing with Western Sufism and sort of bringing in the history of Sufism in general from sort of the Neoplatonic tradition all the way through to probably the latest. Well, the most recent clear current we could find in the West is that of J.G. Bennett, maybe and Idris Shah, a short time after that, with sort of and the stuff he was doing with, was it Octagon Press?
Octagon, yeah. Almost up to the present day, but not quite up to the present day, because there's so much going on at present that would have been almost impossible to cover.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we'll get to that. And Idris Shah is someone I've been looking into recently since I came across the book, The People of the Secret, which is like, yes, if you've heard of that, there's sort of a strange three authors going on and believed to be Idris Shah. But there we go. So before we jump in with the book, tell us a little bit about yourself, what it is you do, and how this book came about. Because I sort of got the impression from reading the beginning that you have a personal relationship with Sufism that might go back quite some time, or am I wrong in that?
Well, I mean, I write as a scholar, so I have a certain sympathy with Sufism, which is good since it's the topic that I spent quite a lot of my professional academic career on. So it's always nice to be able to work with something that you actually like and enjoy as well. I've for the last however many years I've been a professional historian, first at the American University in Cairo, currently at Aarhus University, and working with Islam and working with Sufism. Initially Sufism in the Middle East, that's what I did my PhD on. And over recent years, I'm working more and more on Sufism in the West and related currents in the West, which I find people are actually more interested in, I think. I mean, I have an amazing book about Sufism in the Sudan, but you know, nobody seems to want to read it. The way this book came about is, well, as I said, I've been working with this topic for many years. What I thought is that treatments of Sufism in the West, people tend to write about a particular Sufi order. And even if they're writing more than one Sufi order, it tends to be very, very sort of present oriented. I'm trained as a historian, but that's one reason why I thought I should write a history of it. But I think it's also important to see quite how far back the West's relationship with Sufism goes. And this, over the years, as I was researching this is something that surprised me to find quite how far back it goes. So that's really why I thought that I should write this book. I mean, from the Abbasids, of course, there wasn't really a West in those days, but that's just to make the point of how far back it goes and what it's based on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there's. Even from that, there is a lot of questions I could dig into, especially regarding the East and West divide. But I have to
I like to get the Hermetics question out of here at the start, so we sort of maybe have three thinkers that influence you that you think about a lot that we can bring in later. I see you're already smiling. Everyone loves this question. You can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation. Who do you pick?
Yeah. Well, I had to put into that room René Guénon, who is probably the thinker I've spent most time working on throughout my career. And then I thought that put in a room with him, somebody who I've just finished a project on, who is known either as Ivan Ageli or Abdulhadi Ageli, and who was a Swedish painter who became Muslim and then became a Sufi and wrote a lot about Sufism in about 1910, and who spent a lot of his life living in Cairo. So he went from Sweden to Cairo. I've gone from Cairo to Denmark. So I have a certain fellow feeling with him. And then I thought, well, who do we put in the room to talk with these two? And I thought it'd be interesting to have somebody a bit more contemporary. And my candidate there, if he cares to accept it, is a man called Abdul Hakim Murad, who's also known as Timothy Winter. And he's an English guy in Cambridge who's runs a small organization called the Cambridge Muslim College, I think it's called. And he knows these thinkers, so that'd be a good start. But he's also somewhat critical of them. So I think he would make a very good third party in that conversation.
Okay, so do you think that Hegeli and Guénon would sort of, they would be almost on the defensive against Winter there?
If he wasn't being too polite, which he might be, because, you know, he himself is a Sufi and adept, and, you know, these guys are at least 100 years older than him, so he'd have to treat them with some respect. There are a number of criticisms he would bring up, but I think he also appreciates some of their perspectives a lot, so that's why I think it'd be a good conversation.
Okay. I understand that Guénon eventually became Sufi, and I'm assuming that Hegeli did as well. So as each one of those people had that journey, they weren't, you know, inherently in the culture, so to speak.
Exactly. Yes, okay. Exactly. Which is something that would bring them together.
Do you think there's some differences as to how they got to that stage? You know, how they eventually reached the conclusion that they should follow that path?
Yes. I mean, I think Hegeli, because he was first and foremost a painter.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this almost tradition with painters that they're trying to work out what lies beneath the surface of reality. So quite a lot of painters go off on sort of spiritual esoteric quests, which brings them to various different places. And that brought Hegeli to Islam and to Sufism. Whereas Guénon started off with philosophy, and he went from philosophy into esotericism, and then actually met Hegeli in Paris, and that's how he first got interested in Sufism. I'm not so sure about Abdul Hakim Murad, actually. I mean, he's not a painter, so but he might have started off as a philosopher. It wouldn't surprise me.
So do you think that conversation would go anywhere else other than Sufism, or do you think they would?
I think that they would end up talking about modernity.
Okay. Are they all in sort of somewhat of the same agreement, or is there some clear differences?
Yeah, I mean, they're all a bit critical of modernity. Guénon, very critical. Hegeli, critical more of Western imperialism, I think, most of the time. Abdul Hakim Murad is on the one hand quite critical of modernity, but he's also quite big on the idea that people have to engage in a positive fashion with the world that they're living in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's sort of a difference in their appreciation of the perennial idea that you shouldn't have to change everything to fit your current, that you should be able to work with everything in the world. So Gainon really, he you would say he maybe wanted to alter that in some sense?
Gainon thought that the modern world was reaching the point of final dissolution.
Mm-hmm.
So he was profoundly pessimistic and couldn't quite, I mean, he changed his mind over his career, whether it was far too late to do anything about this or whether there was some hope of saving something from the general wreck of Western civilization. Whereas Abdelhakim Murad is critical of elements of modernity, but thinks that one can find a way of living in.
Okay. Do you mind if I ask, who are you more sympathetic to?
I think Abdelhakim Murad. Okay. I don't see the Western world as on the point of collapse myself. And for many of these people, absolutely heretical, but I think there are some good things about modernity. I mean, I wouldn't prefer to go to a dentist today than 150 years ago.
Yeah, agreed. Okay. I'm sure these thinkers will come back in. But I sort of think we almost have to begin with one of the biggest questions in the study of almost, I guess you'd call it, comparative philosophy, is the question of the East and West, because your book shouldn't be such a maybe difficult title, but simply the title Western Sufism, has so many implications. I mean, obviously, well, is there a difference between the East and Western forms of Sufism? That's the big one. And to a certain extent, do you agree with that divide? I mean, do you agree with it generally, and then do you agree with it in terms of Sufism?
I mean, I think that generally, historically, one can make some sort of a West non-West divide, because the West does have certain things in common. But on the other hand, you know, what people call the East, the non-West or the East, is incredibly diverse. So I think that one can make a West non-West divide if one wants to say something about the West, especially if in practice, as people normally mean, and as I mean in this book as well, they mean the Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
I think if one's thinking about the US and Canada and Scandinavia and the UK and, you know, Germany, but not going too far east, about that area, one can say certain things which hold true of that particular area. But now, East, which contains everything from India to Japan, and some islands in the Pacific that I'm not quite sure I know anything about at all, one can't really talk usefully about the East. Historically, I think it's easier to talk about West and non-West. Today, as a result of globalization,
mm-hmm.
it becomes less and less meaningful. Because the bit of the non-West that I'm most interested in, which is the Muslim world and especially the Arab world, is getting so mixed up with the West in various ways that you can't really make that distinction today in the way that one could have made it in 1920, say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the general question. As far as Sufism is concerned, I think that one can make a useful distinction, because Sufism is something which takes particular forms in particular places at particular times. So I think one can talk about 18th century Egyptian Sufism being different from late 20th century Egyptian Sufism. And in exactly that way, one can talk about Western Sufism. Because, you know, or 20th century Western Sufism, or in fact, early 21st century Western Sufism. You know, this is a phenomenon that has certain characteristics. And some of the differences derive simply from the fact that in the West, Muslims are in a minority. Whereas in the Muslim world, by definition, Muslims are in a majority. So that puts Sufism in a different position in the Western world and in the Muslim world. And then there are also differences connected to education. I mean, far more people in the contemporary West have had a high quality education in the humanities than in the typical Muslim country. So that's a difference. And also perhaps the parts of the West are more globalized. That, you know, if you grow up in a major Western city, you know, you've got some Christians and you've got some yoga and you've got some Gurdjieff and, you know, whereas, okay, I mean, there are certain social milieus in large Muslim cities where people have also know about yoga and Gurdjieff and so forth, but they're much smaller than they would be in a major Western city. So I think there are differences in that respect.
Okay. So it almost seems at this juncture reminiscent, I mean, just to bring it in, of the Neoplatonic tradition, which starts with Plotinus through to Proclus, then Iamblichus, Ficino. As for a contemporary person, who knows? But there's clear differences between those historic evolutions, yes. But they're all adhering to some underlying current. And is that sort of the same thing that's applying with Sufism? There's what could we say that string is which connects them all?
Well, I mean, for the Neoplatonists, we have a basic way of looking at things, which is consistent from, you know, from Plotinus up to the present day, and with Sufism, it's a bit more complicated than that, because Neoplatonism is fundamentally a philosophical school, so it's a way of looking at things. Sufism has its own way of looking at things. It has its own philosophy or theology, in fact, you could call it. But Sufism isn't just a philosophy or a theology. Sufism is also a lot of organizations. It's also practices. It's also stories. What technically we in the science of religions we call mythology. So Sufism is a much more complicated phenomenon than any particular school of philosophical or religious thought like Neoplatonism.
And so, I mean, perhaps we've jumped the gun. Very basic question, I guess. What is Sufism for those who don't know? So we have a base to work with as well.
Oh, you ask that as if it's an easy question. Well, I mean, if you look it up in a dictionary, very often you'll be told that Sufism is Islamic mysticism.
Okay.
Which isn't really true, I'm afraid. I mean, certainly, because we have two problems there. One of them is, what on earth do we mean by mysticism? But if once we've solved that problem, if by mysticism we mean something which is somewhat similar to Neoplatonism, And that's a definition that I would argue for. I'm not sure everybody would agree with me, but I think that's certainly something that I would argue for. If you want to find mysticism in Islam, go and talk to the Sufis. And that is because Sufi theology is very much impacted by Islamic philosophy, and Islamic philosophy is very much impacted by late antique philosophy. So this the Neoplatonic mysticism is an important element of Sufi theology. But as I just said, there are also organizations, there are Sufi brotherhoods, as they're called, tariqa in Arabic, and we tend to call it Sufi brotherhood in English, which is a bit unfortunate because it excludes the women. And there are also females who belong to Sufi brotherhoods. So that perhaps another term would be more appropriate. But there are organizations, and an awful lot of different sorts of people belong to these organizations. So if you go to a little village in the middle of nowhere, you'll find some Sufis who are farmers, and who quite possibly never went to school or have forgotten everything they ever learnt at school and are illiterate. And clearly these guys are not reading difficult philosophical understandings of theology. What are they in it for? Well, it's a form of religious practice for them. It's a form of companionship, even. This is very important in religious phenomena sometimes. You know, it's a social phenomenon. And also, it's connected to various other varieties of religious practice. So it's a very multifaceted phenomenon.
Okay. I once read Alfred Orage say that the difference between a philosopher and a mystic, a philosopher is being through knowledge, and then a mystic is knowledge through being. So that you're working out the world through the practice of being alive and living. Could we say that in that sense, it's an Islamic perspective of actually being and an experiential experience of Islam as in as your being, as experiencing life, and not a sort of analytical sit down, work it out through knowledge?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of analytical Sufis, but I think that on the whole, that would be a good approach to it.
Okay, and in that sense, I mean, it does have many connections with Neoplatonism. Unfortunately for us, most of the initial original Neoplatonist practices are hinted at but completely lost, so we don't even know if they really practiced. But we are lucky in understanding that one of the first Sufist Neoplatonic connections I saw was the... Oh, actually, no, sorry, I'm jumping ahead. One thing I want to make clear is really the connection with Islam, because it is an Islamic... So it is Islamic mysticism, and that current is always there. But from your book, I got the understanding that there was many sort of sects and parts of it which became almost more universal, almost in a... just an all-encompassing religion type idea.
I mean, I think to the extent that Sufism means mysticism, it is universal, because mysticism is universal. And at one point, there was a problem of how to translate mysticism into Arabic and Turkish. And one solution was just to transliterate it and call it mysticism. But another solution was to call it Sufism. So sometimes you get people in the Muslim world talking about Islamic tasawwuf, Islamic Sufism. You think, well, what do they mean by this? The answer is they mean Islamic mysticism, because they're using the word Sufism to mean mysticism. But I mean, historically in the Muslim world, we can follow the development of a number of organizations which are clearly part of the Muslim world and part of Islam. Now, whether to what extent they are quote unquote orthodox is a slightly different question. This one is also complicated by the fact that it's very difficult to say what is orthodoxy in Islam, because the way the religion is structured, it isn't up to any one person. There's no hope to determine what is orthodox and what isn't. So there's room for an enormous variety of different interpretations, which means that it's sometimes it's possible to say what is clearly completely unorthodox in Islam. And occasionally some Sufis have tended a little in that direction. But on the whole, Sufi practices and theology and so forth have remained within that very broad range of possible positions that we can call Islam.
Is there any key changes to the sort of the religious ideas around Sufism when it does finally sort of make a clear appearance in the West? Because you referenced the text, yes. The treatise of the Turks a lot, which is this first, probably the first clear text we have in the what we now know as the West, as something dealing with it in a very, very critical light. And it sort of shows, yes. You know, to me at least, I read that as well, our history of Sufism as it finally arrives in the West is a bit almost tainted, as we can't appreciate what it actually was, because all the texts we have on it are written from this other biased perspective.
Well, I mean, the treatise on the Turks is an amazing text, and I think somebody's got to translate it into English one day and publish it, because it really is such an amazing text. And I mean, on the one hand, it's very critical, but on the other hand, it's, I mean, you know, the basic line of the treatise on the Turks is, if you look at the Turks, you may think they're incredibly civilized with an incredibly marvelous religion. And if you get to know the Sufism well, as I did, you might think that it was so marvelous that you might decide to become a Sufi and convert to Islam, which I, let's talk about something else. The reason for this is that it's very easy to be deceived by the devil. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, he's describing Sufism in very accurate and very, very sympathetic terms. And, you know, frankly, I think it's completely clear that he did actually convert and become a Sufi, though he won't admit this. But on the other hand, you know, he's writing in Europe at a point when Europe is very much under threat from the Turks. He's writing before the Turks lose their last attempt to capture Vienna. He's writing at a point when it's quite conceivable that the Turkish expansion is going to carry on through Western Europe. So it's, you know, it's a bit like writing about the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War. I mean, these guys are the other, and he is therefore very, very critical of them at the same time.
Mm-hmm. What effect do you think that had on the way that Sufism grew in the West over time?
I think that phase of reception, the very early reception there, was overlaid by a later layer of understandings. And I mean, there we've got the first Sufi text to be translated into Latin and then into other European languages, which is Hayy ibn Yaqzan. And this is the Latin translation is given the title The Self-Taught Philosopher. And this text, which is what couple of hundred years later, this text is received very favorably and in some circles quite enthusiastically. The people, oddly, the people who are reading this and receiving it so enthusiastically do not actually realize that they're reading a Sufi text. They think they're reading a philosophical text. But what do we mean by philosophy, of course? They think they're reading a philosophical text, and they think that they are reading a deist text. They think that they're reading a text in defense of rationalism, which they bring into a discussion which has been going on in the early Enlightenment period in Europe about the relative authority of religious revelation, of the Christian churches, and of individual human reason, which is, of course, central to the Enlightenment. So that text is understood by many people as being sort of pro-Enlightenment. And that is a new understanding which grows during, between the Enlightenment and, what, the 19th century. And it's really that understanding of Sufism that sets the scene in Europe and then especially in the 19th century in the United States, that sets the scene to receive the real life Sufis when they start appearing in the West.
Well, it's strange that you mentioned that they didn't even realize that they were reading a Sufi text. I mean, I had this feeling recently, someone recommended me the Walled Garden of Truth. I think, is that the name? I think it's just called The Walled Garden, which is a Sufi text, which I read recently.
Yes.
And that when I was reading it, that came across the same way, that there didn't seem to be too much in it which discerns itself as, you know, a specifically Sufiist thing. Was this a common theme?
Well, I think this is because What we're seeing here is the way that organizationally Sufism is distinct in Islamic culture. I mean, this organization here is a Sufi order. This organization here is for mending the roads and clearing the canals. Mm-hmm. And they're two clearly distinct organizations. But with thought, Sufis were part of the mainstream of Islamic thought and literature. So very often, if you take certain poems, the Sufi poetry became so popular mm-hmm. and so influential that the techniques and images of Sufi poetry were used by all poets. So you can take somebody like Omar Khayyam, for example, and you can read him, and is he a Sufi or is he just writing like a Sufi? What are it? And people have been arguing about this for an awful long time. I mean, even Hafiz, who is very often read in the West as a Sufi poet, but in Iran, people are not so sure. So I think, you know, this is partly why people didn't recognize this as being a Sufi text. I mean, also, you need to know a bit about Sufism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that, you know, in the end, when Haibin Yaxan, having worked out that there has to be a first cause, which could be referred to as the One, decides that it'd be nice to approach the One. He tries spiritual exercises, including fasting, staying up all night, and turning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you don't know anything about Sufism, you think, okay, so that's what he did. If you do know something about Sufism, you think, well, that sounds very familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you've got anybody who is following those particular practices, you know, this is a description of the practices that are Sufi.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, diving in on the Sufi practices, I think these were the sections that really interested me, because I think what interested me the most was whether or not there was big changes in that move from the East to the West, you know, theoretically speaking, because Sufism is obviously still going on in the East as it is in the West, so it's still there, but there's obviously two currents, and whether or not there's changes from the, I guess you'd say, the heredity of the zones, whether or not that changes the actual practice. And the first thing that really appeared in the book as, well, it's just been there from the very beginning, is what we'd now understand as asceticism, and the ascetic practice, and the a certain understanding of the body, which is an understanding of really of it at most as a vessel for experiment, and not anything to be taken in, I don't know, any certain sacred way, which comes from Plotinus's absolute loathsome relationship with his own body. I mean, he absolutely hated it, didn't he? Wouldn't even have a picture of himself made. So does this ascetic practice, does it stay there, or does it change as it comes into the West?
Sufism starts with ascetic practice. The first people who are ever identified as Sufis, the first people we hear of and have accounts of their life, they are all ascetics. And they are super ascetics. So certainly asceticism is extremely important in Sufi practice at the very beginning. Within Sufism in the Muslim world, as Sufism becomes visible later, this extreme ascetic practice is no longer the norm.
Mm-hmm.
So if we are looking at Sufism in 18th century Egypt, for example, yes, there are some people who are following extreme ascetic practices, and it's there as an ideal. But, you know, the farmers in the village I was referring to earlier, they may fast a couple of days on top of Ramadan, you know, but they're not locking themselves up in caves for 40 days or anything like that. So there's a variety of degrees of ascetic practice in mature Sufism over the last few centuries in the Muslim world. And this carries over to the West. So when Sufism originally appears in the West, you've got a small group of people who have been reading about Sufism and they've got very interested in it, and they invite somebody over from Turkey or Sri Lanka or something like that, and this guy turns up and he sort of sits down and he tries to work out, you know, who these people are who've invited him and what they actually want and so forth. Now, initially, he's not going to say, you know, hold on, guys, you've got it all completely wrong. Let me explain how it really works. So, I mean, obviously, you're not going to guess anywhere with that sort of approach. So initially, they say, oh, well, that's very interesting. That's marvelous, isn't it? You know, mashallah, how nice. And then slowly, they try to teach people, which is, of course, fundamental to Sufism in the Muslim world as well. It's fundamental, actually, to most religions, isn't it? You teach people according to their level. I mean, you know, this is fundamental to teaching in a university, a first-year class and an MA class. You teach in different ways, different levels. So these Sufi sheikhs are doing precisely that. And the extreme ascetic practices, I mean, that's the postdoctoral degree. It's not the first-year undergraduate. So we do end up with very serious ascetic practices in the West, just as in the Muslim world. But you know, in both areas, this is not entry level. And I mean, of course, ascetic practices have, I think, probably declined everywhere in the Muslim world as well, with modernity. And one of the things that is very notable is that I mentioned earlier locking yourself up in a cave for 40 days, that the 40-day retreat, you didn't actually have to lock yourself up, but the 40-day retreat used to be pretty standard at a certain level. Now, you know, nowadays, how many weeks holiday do most people get each year? You know, so just for purely practical reasons, that one has been abandoned mostly, or it's far less frequent than it used to be.
Okay, so it's not so much that it came to the West and because of the Western ideals it changed. It's because generally a general level of modernization everywhere, ideals or what's possible changes everywhere. It does always make me wonder how someone, you know, if you had a town sort of monk who was tucked away in a woods or a cave somewhere, how that would be approached these days. Sort of, if they, you know, is there a possibility for modern day desert fathers or sort of, as you say, higher level Sufis to exist in that way anymore?
I think it's possible, but it's more difficult. And there are people like that, but probably fewer than there would have been in an earlier age.
Okay. And I guess how they'd be seen now is different. It probably used to be not so much the norm, but not surprising.
Okay.
I mean, one thing as well, that's when we talk about, like, how we've spoken about how Sufism, if people had heard of it, or if people have heard of it perhaps even now, or when it, you know, started to arise in the West, one thing that they would pop into our mind would be the idea of dervishes. Now, this seems to have sort of overtaken the aesthetic understanding of what a Sufi is. You know, you think of this almost whirling, beautiful madness.
Yes.
And is there any truth to that as being, you know, almost an anchor for the Sufi tradition, or has it stuck because it's so memorable?
I think the first thing that one has to say is that, strictly speaking, a Sufi and a dervish are actually more or less the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That in the East, in the Persian world and in Turkey, you tend to use the word dervish, which comes from Persian. Whereas in the Arab world, you tend to use the word Sufi, which comes from Arabic. So in some ways, they're the same thing. But the word dervish in English and European languages, saying in French and German, brings to mind these 19th century pictures of whirling dervishes and howling dervishes. And also there are these extraordinary 19th century Orientalist paintings by people like Jean-Léon Gérôme, whose very famous painting of a snake charmer appeared on the cover of one edition of Edward Said's Orientalism. And this, you know, this is, it's like many Orientalist paintings of the 19th century, and actually especially paintings by Gérôme, wherever he was, it's sort of halfway between the artistic and the pornographic. And this snake charmer isn't identified as a dervish or a Sufi, but actually snake charmers tended to belong to a particular Sufi order. So there is a sort of connection there with Sufism. So we've got this 19th century imagination of the exotic East and all sorts of strange ideas about sexuality tend to get mixed up into that as well. And this did certainly produce a certain image and understanding of Sufism, which still exists today, I think. And if you go to Istanbul, they do tourist shows of the whirling dervishes, which don't have an awful lot, most of them, to do with real Sufism, and they have quite a lot to do with entertaining tourists.
But I mean, that idea of the exotic East is a really, I mean, that's an important one for me especially, because there's an interesting link that you bring in between the Mahamata, or the Mahatma claims of Blavatsky, which are these, yes, Tibetan masters, which many theosophists have spent years and years trying to find any truth to these claims, and I think some have even gone to the lengths of trying to find them. And then later on after this is the ancient masters, some of which are the Samung Brotherhood, which supposedly, according to Gurdjieff, Jesus attended. And is it Raphael Lefort writes a book, The Teachers of Gurdjieff, where he tries to seek these out, though I think that's been somewhat proven to be a myth. Whether or not he did it, who knows, or whoever that author is. It's that strange side of Gurdjieff literature. And then Bennett goes on to write about these masters as well, as if he knows any more. So this sort of brings in that exotic Eastern idea into the West from Gurdjieff and Bennett, and Blavatsky, who are taking from the Sufist thing. Is there any truth to these sorts of claims in Sufist literature, that such a people, you know, exist? Or is this a Western dramatization to sort of popularize it?
I think it's largely Western. I mean, in any religious tradition, you have bits where somebody says, yes, I got this from somebody impressive. I, Moses, went up a mountain. I met the angel Moroni. And I mean, Sufis, within Sufism, the whole question of the interpretation of dreams is very live. And within Islam, I mean, what happens if you, as a Muslim, dream of the Prophet Muhammad? You know, can you just say, I ate too much cheese last night? Or is this some sort of a communication from the transcendent? So I mean, Sufis do operate with the idea of communications from the transcendent. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, they are not Mahatmas. And they, the whole Sarmung story that we find in Gurdjieff, is, in my view, it's a mistake to take it literally. I mean, when you read Gurdjieff, there wasn't actually a spaceship, right?
He makes this clear as well. So, I mean, I'm sympathetic to what you're saying here. I think he even says at the start of, might have been Meetings with Remarkable Men, he says, the West doesn't know how to read allegorically.
It's clearly allegorical. And when you read Meetings with Remarkable Men, I mean, it's also clear that the Gurdjieff did know something about Sufism. He had met some Sufis. Mm-hmm. But when he seems to be talking about Sufis, he doesn't identify them as Sufis. Mm-hmm. And the people who he does identify as Sufis, the Sarmung, do not sound like Sufis at all. So, you know, it seems to me clear that it was really never intended to be taken as literally true. This. Now, Bennett tried terribly hard. I mean, Bennett did take it literally, and he put an enormous amount of time and effort into trying to identify the Sarmung, and he constructed a theory whereby it might be a branch of something or other that ended up joining with Naqshbandiya, and Naqshbandiya does exist, and we know this, and he knew this. But I mean, Bennett's travels through Turkey and Syria, meeting real Sufis. And also because Bennett spoke very good Ottoman Turkish. So he was in a position to talk to these people, you know, to really understand what they were saying. So he met real Sufis. This is one of the things that I don't quite understand about Bennett, that he met these real Sufis and he stayed with them and he actually became a real Sufi. Mm-hmm. And then he said, no, actually, that isn't what Gurdjieff was talking about. Bye-bye, I'm going back to England. And, I mean, how he kept this idea that the sermon must be really true, despite everything he discovered, despite everything he knew, I find very difficult to understand how this happened. But it did.
Mm-hmm. And then he hands over everything to Idris Shah at the end. Anyway.
Yes. Yes. And that's another mystery.
But I think Bennett's a mystery. He's sort of I think he's a bit of a persona non grata as well for many, for the Gurdjieff, you know, one side of Gurdjieff doesn't really want much to do with him. But yeah, I mean, has the Gurdjieff Bennett appreciation and extension of Sufism, has that altered how our understanding in the West, or is that more of a smaller esoteric type tradition just to their own thing?
I mean, I think you mentioned Idris Shah, and Idris Shah was for a while extremely influential. I mean, in you know, his book on the Sufis in the 70s, in the 80s. Now, this was how, if the average Westerner knew anything about Sufism, they knew it from that book. And that book and Shah's other writings draw quite a lot, I think, on the Gurdjieff tradition. Mm-hmm. So, and as you just mentioned, there was this encounter of Gurdjieff and Bennett. So there's quite a connection there as well. So I think that in some ways the Shah-based understanding of Sufism was actually Gurdjieff-based. Mm-hmm. So yes, there is an impact there. There's also an impact through the Enneagram. Mm-hmm. And what we have here, the Enneagram is a bit like the Sermon, because you know the Enneagram is very ancient and possibly of Sufi origin. Mm-hmm. So read Bennett. Yeah, no, Bennett comes up with this theory.
Okay. Do you know the theory? I'd love to hear the theory.
I would actually have to check this. I'm pretty sure it's Bennett who comes up with this theory. But I would actually have to double check that. So let's leave the Bennett bit out.
Okay, okay.
But let's come back. So the idea develops that the Enneagram is of Sufi origin. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you therefore get various Enneagram people who are working with the Enneagram, mm-hmm. who are Sufis, mm-hmm. and start teaching the Sufi Enneagram. And all of these people have, in their teachings, they have a mixture of Sufism and of Enneagram teaching. And of course, Enneagram teaching, mature Enneagram teaching, is a bit different from Gurdjieff, mm-hmm. anyway, mm-hmm. because that goes several stages further. And if you look at different people who are working with the Sufi Enneagram, sometimes it's very Sufi and a bit Enneagram, and sometimes it's very Enneagram and a bit Sufi. And there are various different possibilities between that. So the yes, I mean, long answer to your question. The Gurdjieff tradition does have a certain impact on the Western understanding of Sufism. I think much more important, though, is actually, at the very beginning, is the whole impact of the Theosophical Society.
Really?
Because it's the Theosophical understanding of Sufism that we find with the followers of Inayat Khan. And Inayat Khan is the first person to establish Sufism in the West. So for several decades, we've really got one understanding of Sufism organized, happening in the West. I mean, if in 1925 you Google how do I become a Sufi, you will end up with the organization that Inayat Khan founded, and you will end up with an organization in which an awful lot of the leading members are former theosophists. And who've brought a lot of their understandings with them.
I see. Blavatsky and theosophy seems to have sort of fallen by the wayside recently.
Yes, and this is very, very strange in some ways, that something which expands so fast and becomes so popular sort of collapses and vanishes. I mean, it's still around, but it used to be the biggest thing in alternative religion, and it certainly is not that any longer. And I mean, this is something that I haven't really looked into in detail myself, but the whole Jiddu Krishnamurti business, I think, has something to do with that. But you announce the world teacher. And then the world teacher says, hold on, actually, sorry, I'm not the world teacher. That was a misunderstanding. I mean, I think it'd be very difficult for any movement to survive that sort of setback.
Yeah. It sort of brings me to a question just relating to contemporary Sufism. I mean, you mentioned that the book doesn't go exactly up to the present day. It'd be very difficult to sort of list everything that's going on in the present day, but is there any clear areas where the currents that you've mentioned in your book, there is still these lineages which find themselves connected to these historical lines?
Yes, I mean, most of them are still around, and most of them have become more Islamic recently. And I think this is part of the globalization that we have today. You know, when you were asking earlier about can one distinguish between West and East, and I was saying that they're intermingling so much today. So you have in the West today people of Muslim ancestry who have been through the same educational experience as you did. I'm not sure what it was, but sort of guessing, right? Yeah. And just as you came out of that experience and all your reading with all sorts of interests and ideas and inspirations and I don't know what else, there are people of Muslim background who've been reading the same books and thinking the same thoughts. And when they go round to the local mosque and sort of try to have a conversation with the imam, the chances that the imam is going to be able to say anything that makes any sense to them at all is pretty small. So where do these guys go? Well, they may end up in one of these Sufi orders of Western origin, where they can be with people who have been reading the same sort of books and the same sort of thoughts. So on the one hand, a lot of the older Western Sufi organizations are moving in an Islamic direction. And simultaneously, a certain number of Western-born, Western-educated Muslims are moving towards these long-established Western Sufi organizations. So, you know, what starts off as Sufism dividing, in a sense, into a Muslim world part and a Western part. Of course, it didn't really divide. The Muslim world part was much, much bigger, but conceptually it divided. What starts as this division, 100 years later, the two seem to be coming back together again.
So do you think that's a way to sort of retain the, that's quite a cheap word, but to retain the spirit of Sufism in the face of an almost Genon type modernity, you know, to find a haven to retain something in the globalized modernity?
Difficult question. Yes, possibly. And I mean, Genon wouldn't have really welcomed this at all. But I mean, if one thinks that it's a way of retaining something, how do you retain something? Well, you either set up a very high fence with barbed wire on the top and surround yourself with this and say, outside world, go away. Or you put up a little slightly symbolic fence that you can actually step over when you want to. Mm-hmm. And say, you know, we are separate, but we are part of this. Mm. So the strategy of trying to keep the outside world completely away, there are some people who do this. You know, I mean, the Amish, as far as I know, not that I know much about the Amish. Certain sorts of very ultra orthodox Jews. And this is very hard. This is really very hard to do, to keep the outside world completely away in that fashion. A strategy which says, yes, in these ways we compromise, in these ways we're part of the surrounding world, but you know, we're doing our own thing. That sort of strategy is probably much more successful, I think. Brings its own dangers with it. But in some ways you can say that this is what some of the long established Western Sufi orders are doing today. And you know, you can see this. One of the big issues always is gender. Mm-hmm. Because now, when you are doing a Sufi ceremony, do the boys and the girls do it together, or do we put the boys over there and the girls over there? Mm-hmm. And anywhere in the Muslim world, until very recently, you're going to put the boys over there and the girls over there. Mm-hmm. But in a Western context, a modern Western context, as soon as you start trying to do that gender segregation, people get uncomfortable because, you know, it's not a Western custom. I mean, we don't do that sort of gender segregation. We mix the boys and girls together. So, you know, how do we deal with this? And some Sufi orders say, okay, we're going to follow standard Western gender norms. We're going to let people mix together. Or some people say, you know, we're going to mix together most of the time, but for this particular ritual, we're going to have the boys over there and the girls over there. But anyhow, that sort of compromise can make you much stronger. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Genon would not agree with this. Mm-hmm. Genon would say, as soon as you compromise with modernity, you're lost. And who wants to compromise with modernity anyhow? Because the whole thing's about to collapse into ruins.
did he have dates?
He didn't have dates.
Okay.
Well, he worked with the Hindu chronology, but then he said that of course these periods are symbolic.
Wow, it's easy to say these things when there's no dates. Okay. I mean, is there anything you'd like to add about the book that you feel we've missed that is key?
I think you've covered most of it fairly well.
Whereabouts can we find it? Is it just available almost anywhere?
Yeah, should be. I mean, I don't think it's on sale at the station bookstore, but I don't think we have station bookstores any longer, do we? So I think Amazon might be a good place.
Yeah. Okay. And you say you're working on something else at the moment, a new project.
Yes, I mean what I'm working on now is a book on traditionalism, that's to say on Guénon's philosophy, and how it's been developed by other people. And this I'm doing for Penguin, and the challenge really that is to explain what it is about this philosophy that has proved so attractive to so many people. Mm-hmm. And traditionalism suddenly became famous with President Trump when it turned out that President Trump's advisor, Steve Bannon, had been reading Guénon. Mm-hmm. And suddenly everybody's saying, you know, what's going on here? And the idea is that it's clear that traditionalism has inspired an awful lot of people in an awful lot of places, but nobody really knows why or what it is. So this is what I'm trying to do, is try to explain traditionalism to people who are not traditionalists and are probably never going to become traditionalists. Mm-hmm. So that's the next project.
Okay, I'll ask you the horrible question. When will that be ready?
If we're lucky, it'll come out next year. I meant to hand in the manuscript at the end of the summer.
Okay.
So if everything goes well, next year.
Okay, I'd love to talk to you about that. Unless there's anything you'd like to add, I think that's a good place to finish up.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much, Mark.